Hello, everyone. I'm delighted to be here with Chris Buchan and Megan Wright from Stewart's Law Firm in the Cayman Islands to talk about the fundamentals of funds in Cayman and Hong Kong. Stewart's is a specialized investment funds firm based in the Cayman Islands. Stewart's has an experienced team of investment fund lawyers with in-depth knowledge, understanding, and expertise. Chris joined Stewart's in May 2019 as senior counsel. He's admitted as a solicitor in a number of jurisdictions, including Cayman, England, and Hong Kong. He was formerly a partner and head of funds and co-head of private equity with Bright Baker and McKenzie in Hong Kong from 1997 to 2002. Subsequently, he's worked as a fund consultant and a global fund administrator. Megan joined Stewart's over 12 years ago. Megan is a solicitor in the UK and Cayman. She has particular specialist experience in funds with blockchain technology and cryptocurrency strategies. She previously worked in the corporate department of a UK law firm. In today's webinar, we'll broadly look at the different Cayman and Hong Kong fund vehicles, the registration requirements, and the ongoing costs and maintenance requirements. Additionally, I'll talk briefly about the latest fund tax developments in Hong Kong and the marketing of funds in Hong Kong. Now, over to Chris to hear about types of funds available in Cayman.
Thanks, Julia. It's great to be here. I have very fond memories of my days in Hong Kong. And likewise, I can't complain too much about the experience I've had here in Cayman for 2 years, notwithstanding lockdown. The Caymans is a great place to live and work. We have a fantastic infrastructure. Normally, we can travel very easily to various destinations in the US, to London, and I'm out in Asia between 2 and 4 times a year in normal circumstances. And I really look forward to the opportunity to come back and enjoy Hong Kong and everything it has to offer as soon as the COVID restrictions allow us to do so. Now, to give some setting, the Cayman Islands have become the leading fund jurisdiction, I think, for a variety of reasons. But perhaps the most important was the initiative taken between a sort of joint venture, a loose joint venture between the private industry here and the government to sell Cayman on a global basis. And I certainly remember when I worked with Baker McKenzie in Hong Kong, that at that point there was 2 or 3 very reputable Cayman firms already in existence. And it was a seamless exercise dealing with them. The jurisdiction has developed rapidly over the last 20, 30 years. And in fact, we're seeing tremendous change going on at the moment, both in the regulatory and legal side of things, but also just the infrastructure on the island. I mean, currently we have a population here of just in excess of 60,000. And in fact, the intention is to take that to 100,000. And a large part of the increase in that population will be professionals, lawyers, accountants, fund administrators coming to live and work in the island. And really, I think that's another part of the success of Cayman. Is it's got a robust but flexible set of fund laws. It's very adaptable. And at the same time, it has a great sort of professional support network of lawyers, accountants, fund administrators. And that's all supported by a very capable and organized government. So notwithstanding the trials of the last year, fortunately, the financial services industry and the funds industry in Cayman has remained very, very buoyant. In fact, it's been quite a good year for us all. If I move on now to generally describe the mutual fund environment, I think it's helpful to give some context to this in terms of the types of fund that typically are established and domiciled in Cayman. And that splits quite nicely between open-ended funds, which traditionally have always been regulated and are the vehicle of choice for the hedge fund industry. And on the other hand, the private fund sector, which has typically been a closed-ended fund, which is suitable for private equity strategies, also residential property or commercial property or sometimes infrastructure, anything that's got a defined period before you can expect to get a return on your investment and which does not offer that type of liquidity. And one of the major developments we had last year was the introduction of the private funds law, which we'll get into in a little bit more detail later in the webinar. But that had a huge impact in terms of bringing into the regulatory environment another 12,500 funds that all had to be registered last year. So it was a very busy time for us. And it also is an indication of the increasing regulation that is a result of many things, but I would say predominantly coming out of the financial crisis. And the response to that from investors that require greater transparency and want to see better corporate governance. So it's generally a good thing, albeit it's only a good thing for the legal industry, lawyers and the accountants. But I think ultimately it's a good thing for the fund management industry. It will help people have confidence when they make investment, and hopefully it will also uncover the bad actors and avoid any kind of frauds or scandals that are very damaging to the industry. Now, if I turn back to the legal aspects of this, the open-ended funds here are governed by the Mutual Funds Act. And there's a definition that applies to a mutual fund. And that is a company, unit trust, or partnership that issues equity interests, the purpose or effect of which is the pooling of investor funds with the aim of spreading investor risk and enabling investors to receive profits or gains from the acquisition, holding, management, or disposal of investments. Now, that's quite a mouthful. But one point I want to sort of emphasize is the Mutual Funds Act applies to the offering of equity interests. So what are they? Well, equity interests are defined as a share, trust, unit, or partnership interest, or any other type of interest that carries an entitlement to participate in the profits or gains of the vehicle. And that can be a company, a unit trust, or a partnership, and which may be redeemed or repurchased at the option of the investor. So the key differentiator here is the redemption function. As I've said, this is the applicable to, in particular, the hedge funds. Now, if I contrast that with the definition of a private fund, a private fund, again, can be a company, unit, trust, or partnership that offers or issues investment interests, the purpose or effect of which is the pooling of investor funds with the aim of enabling investors to receive profits or gains from such entities' acquisition, holding, management, or disposal of investments. So there's some commonality there. But there are two key criteria which apply to private funds. And that one is that the holders of the investment interests can't have day-to-day control over the acquisition, holding, management, or disposal of the investments. And in fact, those investments need to be managed by the operator of the funds. And the operator in the context of a corporate is the board of directors. In the context of a limited partnership is the general partner. Now, as I've said, the private funds are the fund of choice for really the private equity interest industry. And historically, the limited partnership structure has been the structure of choice. And that's really derived from US tax laws, where a partnership is tax transparent for US tax reasons. In terms of the different types of fund that exist, as you'll see from the first slide here, there are different categories of funds. I'll run through these fairly quickly. The first is licensed funds, and that really is a type of fund that's suitable for the retail industry, which is not, it's a very small part of our business here. So for the purpose of this talk, I won't say any more on that. The next category and the next three categories, administered fund, registered funds, limited investor funds, they're all regulated mutual funds that have this redemption mechanic. The difference between registered funds and administered funds is that administered funds are required to be overseen by an administrator. And that means that the administrator, which is a financial institution typically, has oversight and responsibility to ensure that the promoter of the fund are sound and responsible people, but also the responsibility that the conduct of the business is carried on properly. And because of that responsibility and the liability that goes with it, there's an additional cost for administered funds, which essentially means that they're not heavily favored now. And in fact, if you look at the next category in the slide, the registered fund category, now accounts for approximately 96% of all regulated mutual funds in the Cayman Islands. So it's clearly the vehicle of choice. And the requirements there, the minimum investment has to be in excess of 100,000, or the fund has to be listed in the stock exchange. There is another category that I've mentioned, limited investor funds. And again, we had an act that came into force recently during the course of last year, which requires these funds to be regulated. And these are funds that have not more than 15 investors, the majority of whom can appoint or remove the operator of the fund. So they now come within the regulatory ambit. And my colleague Megan will talk to that and to the registration and ongoing obligations with regard to all these types of funds in due course. The final category I've mentioned already, private funds, closed-enders, and we'll get into that in a little bit more detail in due course. So turning now to the specific legal entities that you can use. The first of these is the exempted company. I've also mentioned limited liability companies or LLCs, but for the purpose of this talk, I won't say too much about those because Cayman introduced the LLC legislation in response to demands from the US because it's actually follows very closely the Delaware LLC legislation. So it's not terribly relevant for Asian investors. So I'll focus on exempted companies. Now, the key attributes of the exempted companies are listed in the slide. The first is, as you'd expect, is limited liability, which means that the investor is only liable for the financial commitment they've made. The next items really all go to the ease and speed of incorporation and fund launch. So you can incorporate the fund on the same day. There's no government approval required. And then going forward, there's no requirement to get approval from the regulator, which is CIMA, the Cayman Islands Monetary Authority, for the issue or the transfer of shares in the company. There's no need to have an annual meeting. And if you do so, that's an annual meeting of the investors, it doesn't have to take place in the Cayman Islands. And a critical aspect of the success, obviously, of the Cayman Islands is the fact that it's tax neutral. And it will remain so, in my view, at least through not just the end of my career, but probably the end of my life and beyond. But if you or if a client manager wants to get legal comfort in that, they can obtain, for very modest cost, a tax undertaking from the government, which provides an exemption, a legally binding exemption, that no tax will be imposed for up to 30 years. The next structure that I wanted to speak to is called a segregated portfolio company. This is a very flexible structure which offers a number of benefits. But essentially, from a legal context, what you have within one legal entity is the ability for managers to have separate sub-funds that can carry out different investment strategies and have different types of risk and different terms and conditions and restrictions. And each sub-fund is legally ring-fenced from the other sub-funds and from what we call the general portfolio. And that's critical because it gives the manager the ability to not just pursue different strategies, to bring in different investors with different risk profiles. And there's not a risk for investors in one sub-fund that they will be impacted by poor performance or by some sort of liability arising in another sub-fund. So the segregated portfolios are companies are proving to be very popular. And I've heard that in Asia in particular, for emerging managers and startup managers, they really like the flexibility that these structures offer. So it means that as they develop and build a track record, they can start new sub-funds with different strategies, potentially with different investors, without having to sort of reinvent the wheel and set up a whole new fund structure. And turning now to exempted limited partnerships, I think, as I mentioned before, for tax reasons, these have been structures that are very popular with private equity funds. And traditionally, the big private equity fund managers were predominantly located in the US. Again, they offer very similar benefits, limited liability. So the limited partner, who's the investor, is only liable up to the amount of their commitment. Ease and speed of registration and fund launch. Limited government, well, no government approval in terms of actually activating the vehicle. There is a redemption mechanic, but actually that's, as I've said, because of the closed-end nature of the fund, typically the investors can't redeem when they want to. It's the redemption will usually be a fixed term. Typically, it will be 7 years, and that may be extended up to 10 years at the option of the manager. So that, again, fits with the strategy of investing in real estate, certainly most markets, or any other type of private equity investment in a non-listed company or an infrastructure fund, for example, where the return on the investment is at some future date and the manager needs that money tied in during the period of the investment. Again, you've got the same tax benefits. And in fact, you can obtain a tax undertaking for limited partnership for up to 50 years. And then finally, the last legal entity that's available in Cayman is Cayman Island Unit Trust. Now, these really were introduced have predominantly been used in the context of Japanese managers, Japanese investors, because of their familiarity with the trust structure in Japan. And out with that, they're very rarely used. And in fact, in my experience, I've never dealt with a unit trust fund in the offshore markets. My only experience of having worked in a unit trust fund was when I was at Baker McKenzie in Hong Kong. So I won't say too much more other than it has very much many of the same benefits, but it's not, it's very rarely used in practice. It's not terribly relevant for Hong Kong managers. And then I think finally, to wrap up this part of the presentation, I just want to mention that there is the ability to create different types of structures to meet specific requirements. And to put this in some context, for example, in the US, because of the tax treatment, it's usual for a US manager to want to have a separate fund, which is usually a US domiciled fund for their US investors. And that's the US tax resident investors. And non-US investors plus tax exempts will then invest into a Cayman fund. And those two funds are called feeder funds, which will then in turn invest into a master fund. You've got another variety of that where you can have standalone funds, one for US investors and one for Cayman investors. And you also have something called an umbrella fund, which is a situation where you have a fund which underneath it has a number of sub-funds, each of which carry on, again, a different strategy, but they're not legally segregated. They're contractually segregated in the Articles of Association, but as a matter of law, they're not legally segregated. So I would say that I'm finding that certainly out of Asia, that people are investors and managers are prefer to go with the SPC structure. And I think the last thing I want to mention in terms of the overall general comments on fund structuring is in the vehicle that is most popularly used for hedge funds, the exempted company structure, it's very typical to have two classes of shares. One is for the managers, which will be non-voting, which will be voting, but will not carry on, not carry any economic interest. So that gives the manager the control. And the other is, which is what the participating investors receive, the investors in the fund, which is typically a redeemable preference shares, which will give them the right to redeem and receive a return on their investment and sometimes to receive dividends as well. So that in that way, you've got a very appropriate structure that allows the manager of the fund to retain control, while at the same time, obviously investors benefit from the economic performance in the fund. So I think as a general background, that probably covers everything that I have time for. My colleague Meg will be following up on some further issues on registration and ongoing requirements in due course. But I think at this stage, it's back to you, Julia.
Thanks, Chris. So the Hong Kong fund entities that I'll be covering today are open-ended fund companies, REITs, limited partnership funds, and unit trusts. Although Hong Kong has been considered a major asset management jurisdiction in Asia for some time, the choice of fund vehicles until recently has been very limited. This has changed with the introduction of the open-ended fund company, the OFC, in 2018 and the limited partnership fund in 2020. Funds can now be established in Hong Kong either in corporate form as OFCs, limited partnership funds, or, as previously, in the form of a unit trust. Prior to these changes, Hong Kong companies were sometimes used as quasi-funds, but their inflexible structure meant that most corporate funds used in Hong Kong were established offshore, whilst the previous limited partnership law was outdated. OFCs are incorporated under Part 14A of the Securities and Futures Ordinance, which became operational in July 2018, specifically to allow open-ended funds to be set up in Hong Kong in corporate form. An OFC is an open-ended fund in corporate form domiciled in Hong Kong, which is approved for incorporation by the SFC under the SFO and registered with the company's registry. An OFC is a separate legal entity with a board of directors, and under the SFO, each director of the OFC owes fiduciary duties and statutory duties of care, skill, and diligence to the OFC. An OFC can be established as a private OFC or a public OFC. A private OFC means an OFC which is not authorized by the SFC as a collective investment scheme under the SFO, and so it can only be offered to professional investors in Hong Kong. So when I talk about authorization, I'm talking about authorization under the SFO for offers to the public. A public OFC is an OFC which is authorized for public offer in Hong Kong by the SFC and therefore can be offered to the public in Hong Kong. Key features of an OFC include that the assets of the OFC have to be segregated from the OFC and held by a custodian. The OFC must appoint an investment manager which is licensed or registered with the SFC for Type 9 asset management activity. The OFC can be structured as a single fund, or alternatively, it can be structured to have multiple subfunds. The assets and liabilities of each subfund belong only to that specific subfund and are not available to creditors of another subfund in the event of any of the subfunds' insolvency. Key to the activities of an OFC are the OFC's directors, the investment manager, and the custodian. The SFC Code on Open-Ended Fund Companies, the OFC Code, sets out the requirements for a custodian, which have to be read in conjunction with the SFC Code on Unit Trusts. For private OFCs, the custodian has to meet the same eligibility requirements as set out in the Unit Trust Code. It has to be a licensed corporation or a registered institution, licensed or registered for Type 1 dealing in securities activity, and meet the additional criteria under Chapter 7 of the OFC Code. An OFC's investment management function has to be delegated to an investment manager which is licensed with the SFC for Type 9 asset management activity. A written investment management agreement has to be entered into and has to be in place at all times, saying, among other things, that the OFC has delegated the investment management functions of the OFC to the investment manager. There has to be a minimum of two directors on the board of an OFC who are natural persons over the age of 18. At least one director has to be independent, which means that the director is not a director or employee of the custodian. Directors of an OFC have to be approved by the SFC. To be eligible for appointment to the board of an OFC, the experience and expertise of the people appointed as directors of an OFC taken together must be appropriate for carrying on the OFC's business. The qualifications of the directors are assessed within the context of the OFC's nature, investment objectives, and policies. The OFC provides reasonable flexibility. An OFC in Hong Kong can be established as a single fund, or as I mentioned, it can be established as an umbrella fund with multiple subfunds, each with their own investment objectives, restrictions, and policies. With respect to the subfunds of an umbrella OFC, there are certain protections set out in the OFC rules in the form of implied terms, which are implied in an umbrella OFC's contracts and transactions. These implied terms are aimed at entrenching, insofar as possible, the principle of segregated liability between subfunds and limiting the recourse to assets of a subfund in discharge of a liability not incurred on behalf of that subfund. The OFC regime has already been updated since it was introduced in 2018. One update was the removal of the restrictions on the types of assets private OFCs can invest in. Unlike public OFCs, private OFCs can now invest in any type of asset, as there are no longer any investment restrictions for private OFCs. As mentioned, a public OFC is an OFC which has been authorised by the SFC pursuant to Part 4 of the SFO. Besides being authorised for public offer in Hong Kong, another difference between a private and a public OFC is that a public OFC is subject to certain investment restrictions set out in Chapter 7 of the Unit Trust Code. The key restrictions are a requirement on the spread of investments, a limit on cash deposits, single entity investments, unlisted products, government and other public securities, and a prohibition on investment in physical commodities and real estate. In addition, the offering documents of a public OFC have to meet the additional requirements of Appendix C of the Unit Trust Code, which sets out the information to be disclosed in the offering document. The SFC's fees for OFCs vary between public and private OFCs and also vary between single fund OFCs and umbrella OFCs. As you'll see from the table on the slide, the SFC fees for the establishment of a private OFC range from HK$5,000 for a single OFC to $11,250 for a private umbrella OFC with one subfund. For public OFCs, the SFC's fees range from HK$30,000 for a single public OFC to $67,500 for the establishment of a public umbrella OFC with one subfund. Recent subsidies were announced by the Hong Kong Financial Secretary in the 2021 budget speech. It was announced that the Hong Kong government will provide subsidies to cover 70% of the expenses paid to local professional service providers for OFCs set up in or re-domiciled to Hong Kong in the coming 3 years, subject to a cap of $1 million Hong Kong dollars per OFC. Further details of these subsidies are expected to come from the SFC in due course, but we're not quite clear when that will be. Whilst there is currently no statutory re-domicile mechanism for an overseas corporate fund to re-domicile to Hong Kong as an OFC, in the SFC's consultation conclusions on the OFC regime issued in September 2020, the SFC said that under the proposed re-domicile mechanism, an overseas corporate fund can generally be re-domiciled to Hong Kong as an OFC where it satisfies the key requirements for the registration of an OFC currently applicable to newly established OFCs under the SFO and the OFC rules. These are basic requirements such as the appointment of a Type 9 investment manager, a custodian, and directors who fulfill the eligibility requirements under the SFO, OFC rules, and OFC code. The Hong Kong government targets to submit the necessary legislative proposal in the second quarter of 2021. As mentioned earlier, the Limited Partnership Fund Ordinance is another major development for the asset management industry in Hong Kong. This came into force on the 31st of August 2020. The Hong Kong Limited Partnership Fund is very similar to the offshore Limited Partnership Fund vehicles, which the asset management industry has become used to. Broadly, there's no regulatory approval required, no minimum capital requirements in relation to the limited partners, there are no restrictions on investment, there's flexibility in relation to freedom of contract, and there are broad safe harbours. The registration and formation requirements of a limited partnership formed under the Limited Partnership Fund Ordinance and registered with the Companies Ordinance include the requirement that the limited partnership be constituted by the partnership agreement. It has to have a registered office in Hong Kong and has to be formed with at least one general partner and one limited partner. With regard to the partners of the fund essentially has a two-year grace period within which it will need to either be in operation or have independent partners, which means that all of the partners can't be from the same group of companies. If the limited partnership fails to comply, it runs the risk of being struck off the limited partnership register by the company's registry. Under the limited partnership fund regime, the general partner has a duty to make a number of appointments in relation to the limited partnership fund. These appointments include the appointment of an investment manager, who may be the general partner or another person, to carry out the day-to-day investment management functions of the limited partnership fund and the duty to appoint a local Hong Kong auditor who's independent of the general partner and the investment manager. Under the OFC regime, there's no duty to appoint a custodian. Having said that, the general partner is under duty to ensure the proper custody of the assets of the limited partnership fund. Where the general partner of a limited partnership fund is another limited partnership fund or a non-Hong Kong limited partnership without legal personality, there's an additional requirement to appoint an additional authorized representative of the limited partnership fund to be responsible for the management and control of the fund. Under the ordinance, a limited partnership fund has flexibility in respect of its contractual freedoms and generally has the freedom of contract regarding operations of the fund. In addition to the freedom to contract, the ordinance contains a number of safe harbours for those involved in certain activities of the limited partnership fund. A limited partner can conduct certain activities which will not be regarded as management of the limited partnership fund and will not therefore compromise its limited liability status in respect of the limited partnership fund. Some examples of safe harbour activities provided for include serving on a board or committee of the limited partnership fund, discussing with, advising or approving the general partner or investment manager of the limited partnership, or calling, requesting, attending or participating in a partner's meeting. The ongoing cost for a limited partnership payable to the company's registry is an annual fee of 105 Hong Kong dollars. Other ongoing costs would obviously include tax filing costs, auditors, fees, etc. Turning now to unit trusts. Until the introduction of the OFC and limited partnership fund regimes in Hong Kong, unit trusts were effectively the only widely used Hong Kong fund vehicles. A unit trust is a form of collective investment scheme that's constituted under a trust deed. And as I'm sure you're aware, this enables investors to pool their assets and have those assets professionally managed by an independent investment manager. In Hong Kong, a common form of unit trust is the two-party trust deed. The trust vehicle that's established pools the money of the investors to be invested. The investors in the fund will be issued units of the fund and are beneficiaries, that's unit holders. Under this structure, the investment manager has sole investment power over the underlying assets, which are held in trust by the trustee on behalf of the unit holders who have a beneficial interest in the assets held under the trust. Publicly offered unit trusts have to be authorized by the SFC and are subject to the authorization requirements of the SFC, including the unit trust code. It's the SFC's policy intention that funds that are offered to the public in Hong Kong are subject to the prior authorization of the SFC, unless one of the exemptions under Section 103 of the SFO applies. The unit trust code sets out basic requirements that an SFC authorized fund has to comply with. Now I'll go back to Megan to speak about registration requirements in Cayman.
Thanks very much, Gina. So moving on now to the registration requirements for mutual funds and private funds to register with CIMA in the Cayman Islands. We're required to submit a number of documents and fees, and these include, we've listed them out there, so it's a completed application form and an application fee. The application fee is $4,268. There's also an administrative fee of $366, which also has to be paid at the same time. Secondly, we file the certificate of incorporation and any offering documents together with any supplements to the PPM. An operator affidavit, so that's either, as Chris mentioned previously, the GP or the director. And this affidavit just is declaring that the registered office of that entity is authorised to send the electronic records of the entity to CIMA, and that's under the provisions of the electronic transactions law. We also submit an administrator consent letter together with a local Cayman auditor consent letter. Together with those items, we also submit a structure chart for the entity and together with any relevant constitutional documents. So moving on then to the ongoing obligations for Cayman mutual funds and private funds. We pay an annual fee, which is in fact the same as the application fee that I mentioned previously, so $4,268. The CMA requires a minimum of two directors for what it refers to as the four I's principle, which essentially means that all significant management decisions are taken by more than one person. And for a corporate director of a private fund or GP, that's two named natural persons. Notification, we have to notify CMA of any change of registered office for that entity or any material changes to its offering within 21 days of that change being approved. And we file the amended offering memorandum, PPM, with CMA. And there are significant sort of penalties for not doing so in time. An annual return also has to be produced, and that's in prescribed form. And the fee for that is the same as the administrative fee of $366. Lastly, on this slide, an annual audit by a local Cayman auditor has to be carried out for the entity and filed within 6 months of the financial year end. I should also mention before we move on that directors of a mutual fund and any registrable master fund need to be registered in their own individual right with CMA, and that registration has to be renewed on an annual basis. So moving on to some more ongoing obligations for Cayman mutual funds and private funds. The funds have to comply with the corporate governance principles as set out in CMA's statement of guidance. And broadly, these cover areas such as conduct of business and operators' duties. The funds also have to comply with FATCA and CRS exchange of information requirements, also comply with the AML requirements. Cayman relatively recently updated its AML regulations, which require funds to appoint a money laundering reporting officer, a compliance officer, and also a deputy money laundering reporting officer who would step into the shoes of the money laundering reporting officer should he or she be absent or away. In addition, the funds have to comply with data privacy requirements. So Cayman brought into force the data protection law of 2017 and brought that into force in 2019. And the fund under that legislation would be considered a data controller and therefore would have to comply with the regulations in terms of processing personal data. Finally, private funds must also comply with certain rules surrounding asset valuation, and that's by third party, independent party, or the manager, cash monitoring and custody and safeguarding of fund assets. So back to you, Julia.
Thanks, Megan. So there's a number of regulatory requirements and SFC codes that fund managers in Hong Kong have to comply with. The SFC Fund Managers Code of Conduct applies to licensed fund managers in Hong Kong and requires that certain disclosures be made by the fund manager and numerous other requirements. A number of these disclosures are only applicable to a fund manager that's responsible for the overall management of a fund. To determine whether or not a fund manager is responsible for overall management of a fund, a fact-based review is used to ascertain whether in substance the fund manager is responsible for day-to-day operation and management of the fund. Where the investment manager is responsible for the overall management, the disclosures that have to be made in offering documents include leverage disclosures, summary of the fund manager's securities lending, repo and reverse repo transactions policy, and risk management policy, disclosure of liquidity risks of investment in the fund, and in disclosures in relation to side pockets and side letters, and frequency of valuations and basis of valuations. Fund managers have to ensure that the required disclosures are included in the offering documents of the fund to ensure compliance with the fund manager's code of conduct. The Hong Kong Financial Secretary in his 2021 budget speech emphasised Hong Kong's commitment to developing its REIT market and role as a capital raising hub. So it was announced that subsidies will be provided for qualifying REITs authorised by the SFC and listed in Hong Kong in the coming 3 years. The subsidy will cover 70% of the expenses paid to local professional service providers for the listing of REITs, subject to a cap of 8 million Hong Kong dollars per REIT. The SFC will announce details in due course, and the timing for awarding of the subsidies is not yet clear. The SFC is the primary regulator of REITs in Hong Kong, and a REIT must be authorised by the SFC under Section 104 of the SFO. A REIT is a collective investment scheme constituted by a trust that invests primarily in real estate and raises funds by the sale of units in the REIT. The funds are then used in accordance with the REIT's constitutional documents to maintain, manage and acquire real estate within its portfolio. The SFC code on REITs requires a REIT seeking authorization from the SFC to have certain characteristics. It has to have dedicated investments in real estate that generate recurrent rental income. It has to have active trading of real estate restricted. The greater proportion of income must be derived from rental of real estate. A significant portion of income has to be distributed to holders in the form of regular dividends. A maximum borrowing limit has to be defined, and connected party transactions must be subject to holders' approval. The SFO and the SFC code on REITs set out a number of additional requirements that a REIT must meet, which include an open market in the units of the REIT and the need to appoint an independent trustee, which meets the eligibility criteria of the SFC code on REITs. Unlike Cayman, which for the sort of Cayman funds that we've been talking about today are not subject to any Cayman tax, Hong Kong adopts a territorial source principle of tax, which also applies to funds. At its most basic, this means that only profits which have a source in Hong Kong are taxable in Hong Kong. The Inland Revenue Ordinance has certain exemptions for eligible funds. The most recent amendments in relation to funds are the Inland Revenue Profits Tax Exemption for Funds Amendment Ordinance 2019, which came into force in April 2019. Also, the Inland Revenue Amendment Tax Concessions for Carried Interest Bill 2021 has been gazetted but has not yet come into force. The 2019 amendment provides for a tax exemption for certain funds which meet the qualifying criteria. To qualify, a fund must at all times fulfill certain conditions during the year of assessment. It must meet the definition of a fund under the IRO. The transactions of the fund must be transactions in an asset class set out in Schedule 16 to the IRO, which includes securities and shares, stocks, debentures, loan stocks, funds, bonds or notes of or issued by a private company. And the qualifying transactions I've just referred to must be carried out or be arranged in Hong Kong by or through an SFC licensed company or an authorized financial institute registered under Part 5 of the SFO. In January 2021, the Hong Kong government gazetted the Inland Revenue Amendment Tax Concessions for Carried Interest Bill, as I've mentioned, and this will amend the IRO to provide tax concessions for eligible carried interest distributed by eligible private equity funds operating in Hong Kong. Under the new carried interest exemption, the eligible carried interest distributions would be taxed at 0% rate. Turning now quickly to marketing funds in Hong Kong, this is not a straightforward area of Hong Kong law and really requires a thorough understanding of the restrictions and exemptions set out in the SFO and the Old Companies Ordinance Cap 32. Today, I won't go into a detailed analysis of this area, but I will briefly discuss the restrictions against marketing funds in Hong Kong and look at two possible exemptions that are available under Hong Kong law. Marketing investment funds to potential investors in Hong Kong generally falls within the scope of Type 1, dealing in securities regulated activity. Under the SFO, any person carrying on a regulated activity has to be licensed by the SFC unless an exemption applies. The exemptions are set out in the SFO and the Old Companies Ordinance, and I'll just look quickly at two commonly relied on exemptions. First, the incidental exemption. This is an exemption which can be relied on by an investment manager who is already licensed for Type 9 in asset management regulated activity. This exemption allows the investment manager to market the funds under its management without the need for a Type 1 license. However, if the investment manager wants to market funds which are not under its own management, it would have to add a Type 1 license. For example, this means that an investment manager of an OFC who's already licensed for Type 9 regulated activity can market to the Hong Kong public the funds of the OFC under its management without having to be licensed for Type 1 regulated activity. This exemption is a very limited exemption and can only be relied on by funds as principal. There's a limited exemption from the requirement to be licensed to deal in securities where a person as principal deals with a person who's a professional investor. It must be noted that as defined in this context, the category of professional investors is limited. And the category of high net worth investors set out in the professional investor rules are excluded from this exemption. Only the fund itself can rely on the exemption. All marketing activities have to be conducted by representatives of the fund and not representatives of any intermediary, such as an investment manager or placing agent. And all marketing materials have to be issued in the name of the fund itself in order that the fund meets the requirement that it's dealing as principal. Briefly, the professional investors to which this limited exception applies include licensed investment intermediaries, authorized financial institutions, regulated insurance companies, regulated collective investment schemes, a recognized exchange company, and so on. As mentioned, categories of high net worth investors set out in the professional investor rules are excluded. Now I'll pass over to Chris to discuss the general trends in the market in Cayman.
Thanks again, Julia. So you'll see in the slides, I put up some statistics as to what the, and these are relevant as at the end of last year. And as you can see, there's approximately 12,000 regulated funds. And that number is actually remarkably consistent to the number that has applied over the last 7 or 8 years. So the actual number of funds here has not changed very much. But the categories of funds have changed from time to time. As I mentioned earlier, the most popular for hedge funds are the registered funds, open-ended, exempted companies. And the big change in Cayman last year was the introduction under the private funds law of the requirements to register private funds, which kept us all extremely busy, as I mentioned before. And you can see that there's almost another 12,500, just a bit more, private funds that actually were registered and are now regulated in Cayman. And that's great business for the Cayman Islands, because not only does that mean that the lawyers are involved in handling the registration of the funds and dealing with the ongoing regulatory issues and compliance issues, but you also have a requirement for Cayman auditors to audit each of these funds, which did not exist before. So the lawyers and auditors were pretty happy with the introduction of the new rules. But as I said, more seriously, I think it's generally good for the industry as a whole. In terms of some general trends I've seen over the last year, as I said, while the number of funds has remained stable, I think without question, the value of assets under management is probably increased significantly. Now, we don't have statistics on that are easy to access. We do know that, we think that the mutual fund market in Cayman is in excess of $4 trillion under management, and there's probably a similar amount under management in the private fund sector. So it's a huge number in terms of assets under management. What we can determine is, and I think this has been responsive to the increase in regulation resulting from the financial crisis and the cost of adhering to regulation and compliance costs generally, we're seeing that the fund sizes are getting bigger. And in fact, just over 50% of regulated funds in Cayman, we understand, are in excess of $1 billion. Having said that, there's also still an active emerging manager and startup manager sector. And I would say that approximately 20 to 25%, we think, of the funds that are now regulated in Cayman are probably under $100 million US dollars. Beyond that, I think we're also seeing, in response to this, what people sometimes refer to as tsunami of regulation, the compliance and funds industry is developing. So we're retooling and we're refocusing in terms of legal advice from dealing with fund launches and ongoing legal work relating to the contractual documents, funds, amending offering documents, and so on. I would say that the biggest change is the amount of time that we're spending on regulatory and compliance work, and particularly working with managers to ensure that they are fully compliant, that they have in place the right policies and procedures, manuals, and that they're careful that they're not missing deadlines and so on. Because one of the things that I think we'll without question be seeing more of going forward is more emphasis by the regulator here on complying and doing things in accordance with the timetable that you're required to comply with. And part of that is in response to the OECD and general rules that are now in place internationally in terms of ensuring that there's not money laundering problems or tax evasion. And you know, part of it, I think, is being responsive to the realistic demand now of investors for greater transparency. So that unfortunately does mean that costs are going up in terms of manager costs to deal with compliance, but I think that's more than outweighed by the benefit of avoiding frauds or mishaps that would undermine confidence in the industry, particularly post-financial crisis. In addition, corporate governance is becoming it's taken much more seriously now than it used to be. So there is a requirement, as Megan mentioned, for regulated funds to have two directors, each of whom have to be registered with CIMA and have to be fit and proper people. But in addition to that, what I think we're seeing is people are not taking on as many directorships, and the investors are looking and doing due diligence on independent directors. So they expect those directors to be meaningfully involved in the management and supervision of the fund, which is a significant additional sort of development, and I think a very welcome one. So we are seeing directors, professional directors, companies growing in size. We're seeing more and more people coming from the legal industry, the accounting industry, and taking on directorships. But fortunately, what is reducing is the situation we had, I would say, a number of years ago, where partners in law firms, directors of administrators, were taking on a huge number of directorships and just frankly not giving enough time to carry out the proper supervision that was required. So I think my takeaway from the emerging trends in the Cayman Islands is that we are expecting to see increased focus on regulation and compliance, but we have a flexible system here in terms of the interaction between the industry and government. And government's very good at being responsive to industry needs. It's very good with consultation exercises. And I think it fully appreciates the financial services industry is absolutely fundamental to the Cayman Islands' continued growth. So I'm very confident that we have a very good outlook, particularly in respect to, if you look at what's happening in the economies, the major economies such as the US post-COVID, and with the infusion of funds from government and so on into the sector. I think we're going to see a lot of activity going forward in 2022 in particular. So back to you, Julia.
Thanks, Chris. So in terms of the Hong Kong fund vehicles that I've been talking about, as of the 24th of March 2021, there were 13 OFCs registered with the Companies Registry in Hong Kong, according to the Companies Registry website. There have also been over 100 registered limited partnership funds. Hong Kong continues, of course, to position itself as a premium asset management jurisdiction in Asia. And the SFC's Asset and Wealth Management Activities Survey of 2019 says that as at the year end, the assets under management of the asset management and fund advisory businesses conducted by Hong Kong SFC licensed companies and registered institutions had increased year on year by 22%, and also said that assets managed in Hong Kong made up 56% of the assets under management of the asset management business with 52% of these assets invested in equities as at the end of December 2019. So the introduction of legislation to provide a mechanism for offshore corporate funds to re-domicile to Hong Kong, I think, will be particularly useful for Hong Kong, whilst the tax exemptions and the subsidies for professional fees in setting up OFC funds should make setting up funds in Hong Kong more attractive. However, the Cayman Islands still appears to be a jurisdiction of choice for many of our clients to establish funds. This is particularly true among our clients from China. The Cayman Islands clearly has a track record as a premium funds jurisdiction. And that although Hong Kong is making encouraging progress, it really, I think, remains to be seen whether or how quickly it can catch up with the Cayman Islands as a preferred jurisdiction for establishing funds. I think we should, however, remember that Hong Kong is a major center in Asia for asset management, which is, of course, a different metric from the number of funds that have actually been established either in Cayman or in Hong Kong. However, it's clearly optimal when these two aspects can be aligned. So this brings us to the conclusion of the formal part of the webinar. So that just remains for me to thank you all for joining us today, to thank Chris and Megan for joining with me. And we do hope we'll see you all again soon, perhaps for another funds webinar. Bye.